Welcome back to Byline. I'm Rick Howlett. Well, yesterday, Mayor Greg Fisher unveiled his proposed city budget for the fiscal year that begins July 1st. The mayor had warned that it would be an austere spending plan, as Metro government has been facing a multi-million dollar shortfall. Here to talk about it is WFPL political editor Philip M. Bailey. Philip, welcome back.
Hey, Rick.
Well, I guess a lot of this depends on where you sit, but the budget appears to be austere, but not quite draconian.
Not totally. I mean, as the mayor said, it's not all gloom and doom. And I think for many observers, residents, and council members, there's a sign, at least, that maybe we're starting to turn on the corner here as far as getting the cities beginning to crawl into recovery. Still seeing some of these large deficits, about a $20 million shortfall for next year's budget. But the mayor said he balanced that with a number of different measures and was able to make some highlights of his own as far as certain spending where he wants to make certain investments. For example, you're seeing $500,000 being put into buying land for West Louisville development, economic development out there. The city's putting in $100,000. It's also being matched by $900,000 in the private sector to create this $1 million summer jobs program. The mayor said is we see the federal government pulling funding out of sectors like that. It's important for the city to invest in that area. Also, I think one of the things that got the biggest applause line was the Southwest Regional Library, which the city will pay $9.5 million, and the Library Foundation will raise $3.5 million to get that project under construction. That $9.5 million is the only bond that the mayor took out, so that's the only money that he's borrowing. Also of interest is the $500,000 that's going to be used to help development down on 4th Street Live, and we have a clip here where the mayor talks about how important it is to invest into downtown Louisville.
We know that we need a thriving retail section of downtown to support residential life, downtown workers, and out-of-town guests. In fact, the top question that's asked by downtown visitors is, where can I shop? South 4th Street, the historic shopping center of our city, is the most likely place for downtown retail to take off, and it's beginning to get some lift. We'll be investing $500,000 there, paying for better lighting, an important safety issue, as well as sidewalk and other improvements. Growth there is going to have the added benefit of generating new downtown tax dollars that will be added to the arena TIF.
So you see, you know, the mayor is not just making cuts and laying folks out there. Actually, no layoffs, no furloughs. Actually, non-union employees will get a 2% raise increase. So you're seeing here another example of the mayor trying to make some of those investments. Now, this budget is not without controversy. There is this issue that came up during the press briefing where Chief Financial Officer Steve Rowland says the park is going to pay the city $3.9 million for two garages, which park purchased from the former county government. But at the time of merger, that transaction is now on the receivables. So, which, I mean, in layman terms, that means that park never paid post-merger for those lots that was owned by the former county government. So This has raised some questions from some council members, particularly Council President Jim King, wondering, number one, how is it that those garages were sold during merger and the city's never received any payment until just now? And also the question of, will there be a reappraisal for those buildings to where we should charge perhaps interest to get the taxpayers the money back? Because $3.9 million back in 2003 is probably more than that now in 2012.
As you may have mentioned, no layoffs or furloughs in the budget. But who's going to be complaining the most? Who are we going to be hearing from?
I think you're going to hear arts groups and a number of social services organizations complain. Let's remember that when people say that, you know, the mayor can say, well, I didn't cut the budget. Well, technically, we all know when he proposes a budget, the Metro Council revises it. They can add money they usually do to certain external agencies. And the mayor's proposal is short of what it was last year, which the council passed. So many arts groups and social service organizations are complaining about the lack of funding. I think you will hear some complaints from University of Louisville Hospital as far as the Indigent Care Fund. The city is only putting in $7 million this time. Usually they put in about 9.6 and usually get that rebate back from University Hospital, but this year it's just going to be $7 million up front. So there will be some issues there, and the council members are saying, hey, listen, we're just now getting the budget just like the rest of you all are, so we're going to have a month to go over this and pull some things in and out, whether it's Louisville Metro Animal Services, whether it's public safety. We have many questions we want to ask over the next month, so we could see this budget go anywhere. Mm-hmm. But at this point, I think the good news is that, like you said, no layoffs, no furloughs, and no tax increases.
So what happens now? There are going to be hearings?
Yes, the budget hearings will begin next week. I believe it starts with public safety, but over the next month, you'll have different department heads come in and explain what they plan to do with these funds or how they plan to meet these requirements or go try to make budget. Also, the projections as far as growth, which is, I think, expected to be about 2.4%, so moderate marginal growth at best. And then you'll also have time for members of the public to come in and share their views and see how they want the budget to go. And then, of course, council members will draft one and craft one that we will hopefully will see pass before July 1st.
And again, the mayor has cautioned that the next budget could be equally austere.
Yeah, because in this budget address, the mayor spent most of his time talking about the structural imbalance. And he said he's addressed that a little bit as far as dealing with the overtime cost. People may remember the audit showing that overtime costs were exponential. He sort of brought some reforms to that system in the sense that you can't get overtime unless you work at least 40 hours a week as a Metro employee. Some council members, particularly on the Republican side, are saying, and Councilman Jerry Miller, I think, is leading this chorus, saying that, you know, we need to be a bit more aggressive with this. It's a good start to deal with overtime as far as that $3 million in reduction, but there are some other structural imbalances out there as far as employee benefits and health care costs and things of that nature that we need to deal with as a city. So, you know, in the future, I think Fisher's legacy will be in these budgets. How will he deal with that structural imbalance? How will he be able to put that at ease so we don't have, whether the economy is good or bad, the city's budget starting off at a deficit?
All right, and again, Metro Council budget hearings are upcoming. Philip, thanks for enlightening us on the city budget, and we're going to keep an eye on the proceedings as they go on. We're going to switch gears now and talk about the election, the primary election from Tuesday night, and the stage is now set for the November general election here in Kentucky and elsewhere. First of all, we'll go back to you, Philip, and joining us is Gabe Buller, WFPL News Director, and Kenny Colston, the Frankfort Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio, which includes WFPL. Welcome in, guys.
Hey.
Thanks.
But I want to go back to you, Philip. A big night for the Tea Party the other night.
Yeah, I mean, not only did we see the Tea Party, I think, grab another congressional seat with Thomas Massie winning the Republican race for the 4th District, and likely will go on to win the general election in that heavily Republican district. But we saw here even at the Metro Council, a Tea Party candidate, Marilyn Parker, beat incumbent John Ackerson, Republican, in the 18th district by 37 votes. And this was a nail biter really to the end, Rick. And people might remember the majority of council members on the Metro Council backed Parker over Ackerson and were using pretty harsh language, saying things like that Ackerson wasn't trustworthy, going as far as to say that he sort of made backroom deals with Democrats to shut down debates on key issues. So they not only supported him verbally, and politically, but also financially. So many council members backed Parker's campaign over Ackerson, and we saw her pull it out really by 37 votes. Now, the question for Parker, I think, is that even though District 18 is a heavily Republican district, she's likely to win that one, she's a bit controversial. Not only has she spoken out against the Jefferson County Public School student assignment plan, and she's a member of the Tea Party, but she's also flirted with the birther movement. For those who are not familiar with that movement, the movement that questions whether President Obama is actually a U.S. citizen. I talked to Ms. Parker about those views last week, and she sort of had stood on both sides of the fence.
Did you ever at one point contest President Obama's citizenship as far as his birth certificate was concerned?
I think it's something that every voter should look at because there's so much out there about it. You know, it's a dead issue. Not many people are talking about it right now. The election's, you know, coming up, and it probably won't make any difference. I think there is something going on out in Arizona right now where a guy in leadership is requesting proof of that, and they might not put him on the ballot in Arizona. But, you know, it's an issue that was out there, but, you know, Hillary Clinton was the one that brought it up in the first place, and that's what gave it airtime.
Do you think that President Obama is a U.S. citizen?
Judging from right now, I think that, you know, I'm not going to answer that because it doesn't have anything to do with this Metro Council race. It'll just be sensationalized in the media, and
okay,
you know, so I'm not going to answer it.
Before each council meeting, members of the council take the Pledge of Allegiance, and you take the Pledge of Allegiance, I'm assuming, as well.
Uh-huh.
President Obama is considered the Commander-in-Chief, so if someone doesn't believe that he is a rightful U.S. citizen, I mean, that would be a pretty, I would think, a pretty serious matter if the commander-in-chief is not an actual U.S. citizen.
You're right. Absolutely, it would. That's why there's so much controversy over it.
So I guess point blank, I mean, do you think he's a U.S. citizen?
You know what? Given the information, I mean, he put out a birth certificate, so I would have to say at this point right now, I would say yes. From the information that we have at this point, I would say yes, I think he is a U.S. citizen.
So, okay, this birther issue,
you're
I mean,
speechless.
Yes, literally. I mean, because the fact that this is even an issue, I think is problematic in a number of ways for many members of the Metro Council, including Councilwoman Tina Ward-Pugh, who has said in the past, you know, she welcomes women on the Metro Council, but she's a bit worried about issues like this coming out from Ms. Parker. I talked to Councilman Ken Fleming, who's the chair of the Republican caucus. He says, you know, this is a federal issue. When she ran for Congress, Parker addressed this, but she's not addressing this as a Metro Council. But then I asked him, was President Obama a U.S. citizen? And he gave the answer, well, I don't have enough documentation to comment. Mm-hmm. I mean, the idea that someone would have to produce a birth certificate, I don't know how many times, Rick, you were asked to produce your birth certificate to prove you're a citizen, but the fact that this is a sort of even a political talking point on the right, I think raises some questions for people about Parker's candidacy. It's unlikely that it'll deter her at all. She has been very focused on this race and has been a very great challenger and the second person who's to unseat an incumbent on the Metro Council's history. So, but still, the mere fact that this is even an issue that someone can't answer straightforward, yes, he's a U.S. citizen, he's the president of the United States, I think it worries a few political observers, to say the least.
Does she have any views on issues that would affect the council district she'd be representing?
Well, she has. Thank you. She has come out and said she wants to cut discretionary spending. She said that, you know, that's a part of fiscal responsibility. I believe it said that she wants to cut it by at least 50%. So there are some council issues. She certainly wants to tighten ethics reform. Even though these controversial issues seem to be more and more talked about more and more, she's certainly someone who I think many expect will have a conservative voice on the council on issues involving city government.
We'll come back to the council in just a moment. Kenny, I want to turn to you because Philip mentioned the 4th District Congressional race and the hand of Rand Paul, very evident in this win by Massey.
Yeah, Senator Rand Paul had made basically his first Kentucky endorsement. He's gone out of state for a lot of U.S. Senate endorsements. This is the first time he got involved in a Kentucky race in that 4th Congressional District, and he endorsed Thomas Massey, who was kind of the Tea Party guy in that race. And Massey had a very, not surprising victory, but I would say the margin on Tuesday night was very surprising. I mean, outpacing his nearest opponent by 20-something points. It was never close. Massey had a lot of advantages. Obviously, Rand Paul's endorsement helped coalesce Tea Party behind Massey. Also had a lot of outside super PAC help, almost half a million, that'd be insane, but half a million dollars in ads that was almost saturation. I mean, you couldn't turn on the TV or watch a news program without seeing an attack ad against the other two front runners, Gary Moore or Alicia Webb Edgington. But a very strong performance by Thomas Massey. It gives Rand Paul some more weight here in the state that, you know, his endorsement does carry. And although I will say this, I'm not sure this will open the door to the floodgates of the Rand Paul endorsements. I think considering his election, an endorsement from Senator McConnell played so much into his election to the U.S. Senate, he'll probably be selective like McConnell, but it definitely gives him some weight.
I want to turn to the presidential race. Gabe, you reported this week that the uncommitted won 42% of Kentucky's Democratic primary vote, and of course one of the other candidates is Barack Obama.
Yeah, the only other candidate. I think a lot of people were surprised watching the election returns on Tuesday night to see that the President of the United States garnered just 58% of supporters from his own party, pretty much, of registered Democrats who went out to vote in Kentucky. And it's surprising to see, but we were doing some analysis of this and looking at these numbers, and there's a lot of debate going on locally and nationally about what all this means. But a phrase that Kenny used and that I just shamelessly stole is that these voters who voted uncommitted, it's about 87,000 people, are a fraction of a fraction. They're the fraction of people who actually came out to vote. Turnout overall for both parties was just under 14%, which is very, very low. And since it's closed primaries in Kentucky, anyone who's a registered Democrat is going to go out and they have to vote a Democratic ballot. But a lot of people who are registered Democrats in Kentucky are registered to vote on the city level, on the levels where there's a little bit more action on the Democratic side. And for national issues, they will likely almost always favor a Republican candidate. These are people who are likely going to vote for Mitt Romney, who may have supported Rick Santorum or Ron Paul even, who also garnered a bit of the Republican primary vote. So it does seem like it's surprising. And then if you look at these numbers of who voted for whom, it starts to become even more clear. The president did not get a lot of votes outside of cities. He didn't get votes in rural areas in general. There's one county where he tied, I think, at 479 votes with uncommitted. But mostly, you look at the map, and it's blue in the middle for where people voted for the president, and green on the Secretary of State's website, at least in the east and west parts of the state. It's also a big coal area, and you know, the campaign from the coal industry against the president is also pretty severe, and we've seen a lot of that.
I also don't think we can discount, I mean, the elephant in the room, which is race.
Right.
I mean, at the end of the day, people will remember back in 2008, in the Democratic primary between President Obama and Hillary Clinton, that I believe an exit poll showed that 20% of Democratic voters in Kentucky said that race was a leading factor in the decision-making in that election. We're talking about rural Kentucky here, a place where there are very few, if any, African-American faces. Some of the reports that were done by the BBC, Think Progress, and others back in 2008, I think, showed a very ugly side of the Democratic Party that the Democratic leaders do not want to talk about. You also have to remember the fact that the leader of the Democratic Party here in the state, Steve Beshear, the governor, did everything possible to run away from President Obama during his gubernatorial race. You've had many Democrats come out and denounce President Obama here in the state. So, you know, the idea that, as someone observed on Twitter, you know, the idea that the national political party, the National Democratic Party, has anything to do, much connection with rural Democrats in this state, I think is clearly a continuation we see here in the state between the bad relationship between President Obama and state Democrats that just only continues and is exacerbated more and more. I can't think of a time where a sitting U.S. president, his own party, did so much to reject him or distance himself from him, and not only their leadership, but in their voters.
Right. In some ways, they are following the example of some elected Democrats in Kentucky. And in bringing up the race issue, that is an issue that some people have been quick to dismiss, pointing out some of those other things, turnout numbers and all that, coal country even. But the fact is that there were a lot of issues uncovered in 2008 by various reports, Think Progress and the BBC, and it would be hard to think that all those issues vanished
in
4 years.
And let's also recall, Kentucky has never elected an African-American statewide.
Mm-hmm. No, that's correct. Before we say goodbye to you folks, Philip, I want to circle back to the Metro Council very quickly. Attica Scott, the winner in the 1st District, and Barbara Shanklin in the 2nd District on the Metro Council, two races that have been...
Let's start with District 2. I mean, many people think the fact that, you know, Councilwoman Shanklin, always very popular in her district, despite the fact that she had this controversy involving her grandson, she was running against really two low-name candidates who really split the vote. Councilwoman Shanklin only got 48%. In District 1, I think many were surprised of how much flex that Councilwoman Scott showed against her opponents. I think Stephen Colston did very well in the Southwest, better than expected for many. Ray Bark only got about 24%. Of note, though, should be that 2 years ago, former Councilwoman Judy Green got 2,000 votes in that primary. She almost got more votes in that race than total voted for in this race. So if she had brought those votes with her, she would still win. So I think many people are wondering, could Councilwoman Green in 2 years run for this seat again and win it? Clearly the votes show that she could.
All right, Philip M. Bailey, Gabe Bullard, Kenny Colston, thanks for joining us as we set the stage for the November general election in Kentucky.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This is Byline on WFPL. Courier Journal publisher Wesley Jackson is in an odd position. He's essentially the connection between a local institution, the paper, and a giant national corporation, CJ parent company Gannett. During a dramatic shift, with revenue waning and orders from Gannett, the Courier will soon start charging visitors to its website who read more than a certain number of articles each month. The paper will also make changes in its content to focus on watchdog journalism and lifestyle stories. WFPL's Gabe Bullard talked with Jackson about the changes coming to the Courier Journal.
This is a time of a pretty great change at the newspaper. And I was wondering how you see your role at the Courier. Do you see yourself as restoring an institution to a place in the community it once had, or do you see yourself as transitioning into a new era for the Courier Journal?
Well, I think we are keeping parts of, I think, what has made this organization great. We need to transform this organization as well as we start to really consider the number of different ways people are receiving their news and information, and certainly the challenges facing our advertisers as well, and finding new ways to reach people both digitally and using our printed products. I do see my role as respecting the tremendous history of this organization and its core mission to serve this community, and doing that in all of the new ways that people are receiving their information, and including the newspaper itself, the printed edition.
One big change that's coming up soon, and I think the change that most people are talking about, is the addition of a paywall.
You know, the paywall itself is for subscribers. They should, once they activate their account, they'll never notice any meaningful difference in terms of how they access the content. What they'll see is more content on our website. If you're not a subscriber, there'll be a certain number of articles you can view at no charge every 30-day period of time, and will allow them, in essence, to sample our content. What it won't be, though, is, for instance, I believe it was the Wall Street Journal, allows you to see the first paragraph, for instance, of an article if you're not a subscriber.
Mm-hmm.
You will actually be able to see the entire article, and if it's a video that we have on our website, the entire video and all the surrounding information, and that will count as one article experience. So people will still be able to experience some of our content, but to have full access to all of it, you'll need to be a subscriber.
What's the limit for articles that someone can look at before they have to become a subscriber each month?
Right now, that number will change over time, so we're still working on setting that exact amount, but it will be between 10 and probably 20 articles each month.
And how well do you think the paywall will work providing the needed revenue that it should?
We believe it's going to be effective. I think a couple of things that are a part of this is we look at our overall subscription model. One of the things that we have to do is take into account certainly our investments that we're trying to make in content after, you know, we've been in a process of reducing our overall journalistic staff, everything else, and what we're trying to do is stem that tide, number one, and make sure that we keep enough scale in the market to continue to cover the issues that are relevant. And with that, we still have, even after the early retirement program that I think, you know, was pretty well publicly acknowledged and some of the layoffs that we've had, we still have more journalists covering local news and information than any other organization in the state of Kentucky. And as we start looking at those, plus increasing delivery cost of the printed version, newsprint and ink, we have to increase our prices of the printed product, and as well as begin to charge for access to our digital product as well. So that combination, we think what will happen is most of our subscribers, a large portion, will access us in print as well as digitally, and some of that will bring new people to our digital assets, whether that's the website proper or through our iPhone or iPad application.
You mentioned that there have been layoffs and there have been early retirement offers, and while the Courier does have the most reporters of any news outlet in the state, it's fewer reporters than there used to be, and the digital product has been free for so long. How do you think people will adapt to paying for the first of all, just paying in general, and they're getting less reporting than they got, say, a year ago for free?
Well, I think part of that is, first, on the website, if you look at the amount of content that we can edit, evaluate, and then originate with our reporters, there's a significant amount of content on the website and through our digital offerings that we just can't put in the paper. Just from the raw volume of that. So I think the overall content that people have access to in some ways has grown significantly via the website. I also say that, you know, the hard fact for us is that we have to begin to reorganize our business, which we have begun before I got here. And with that reorganization, as we start looking at how we transform and use digital to share more information than we can in print, take advantage of that, of those opportunities for our subscribers, and focus our resources that we have into stories, information, and content that is local, relevant, and high impact. And the combination of those two items, I think, can still bring a very compelling product to the marketplace for the price we charge for it.
That's Courier-Journal publisher Wesley Jackson. He spoke with WFPL's Gabe Bullard. We'll be back with more in a moment. This is Byline on WFPL.